It's the way people come to understand the world outside of their own conversations and their reading. Can you talk about how the media addresses climate change?
Yeah, so I was reading some articles about the flooding in Western North Carolina in the New York Times. The articles did not even mention climate change, not a single mention. This is what's driving it. And then there's the larger context of irreversible global overheating, which I've already mentioned. It's caused by the fossil fuel industry. They've been lying and blocking action systematically for decades, and this impact will get worse. We'll see even worse storms in the future. It's all like the gradation of climate impacts, everything we've been seeing around the world happening more frequently, more intensely, until, you know, global systems of infrastructure, food, water start to break down in ways that are hard to imagine for us right now. This all gets worse as things get hotter and hotter, driven by the fossil fuel industry, which has been lying. I think that's critical. Obviously, probably shouldn't say it in such an emotional way as what I've just said, because they're trying to be objective reporters. I'm speaking as a human right now, as a parent. But they need to, reporters need to start giving this whole context. This is part of the whole story.
We have 5 seconds, Peter.
Yeah. Anyway, do better, media, please.
Peter Kalmus, climate activist, climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, speaking on his own behalf, not on behalf of NASA. Happy birthday to Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned to KBOO, Portland.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm/runningonair. Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Hurricane Helene devastates the southeastern United States.
The group People for Portland disbands.
And local therapists unionize ahead of an expected merger between Legacy Health and OHSU.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 30th, 2024. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. The death toll for Hurricane Helene continues to climb as rescuers try to track down 600 unaccounted community members. Since its landfall on Thursday evening, the storm claimed at least 130 lives in the southeastern United States. Power lines and cell phone towers have been down since Friday morning and are expected to stay out for a while longer. The property damage is staggering, with scenes of houses with their roofs ripped off, buildings completely flattened, and entire towns washed away. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, is under scrutiny for what North Carolina Representative Chuck Edwards called a slow response to the storm. Helene is the deadliest storm since Hurricane Ian in 2022, which left 156 dead. Hurricane Maria in 2017 claimed 3,000 lives in Puerto Rico. An internal report from FEMA acknowledged the agency failed to properly prepare for hurricane season and inadequately supported Puerto Rico that year. Emergency workers continue to deliver supplies despite collapsed roads and failed infrastructure to the Carolinas, Georgia, Virginia, Tennessee, Ohio, and Florida.
The dark money organization People for Portland announced it is dissolving just days before the November election. Kevin Looper and Dan Levy founded the political group responsible for controversial billboards and Facebook ads. They launched in 2021, urging supporters to, quote, take action and rescue our broken city, end quote, in the aftermath of 2020's rising housing costs and increased houselessness. Billboards targeting District Attorney Mike Schmidt, saying Portland is a Schmidt show, and Facebook ads targeting Metro President Lynn Peterson quickly caught Portlanders' attention. In 2022, the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555 filed a complaint to the Secretary of State, saying their messaging clearly supported or opposed candidates, which means they violated campaign finance laws. Instead, Levy and Looper filed as a 501c4, a nonprofit public benefit corporation that can keep its funding list private. Jordan Schnitzer and Tim Boyle of Columbia Sportswear admit to helping fund People for Portland. The Secretary of State officially notified People for Portland in March of this year that the group violated Oregon election law by failing to file campaign finance transactions as an independent expenditure filer. Another lawsuit was filed last year, saying People for Portland should have filed as a political action committee. Levy and Looper deny that the organization is closing due to these lawsuits. Instead, they claimed the victory for rolling back Measure 110, getting the camping ban passed, and keeping Mike Schmidt from getting reelected as reason to say goodbye. Looper says, quote, it's clear we've changed the politics of Portland, which is what we set out to do when we started this, end quote. The city of Portland sued Looper and his consulting firm last year, among a list of other businesses, for not paying taxes. Levy declined to say what will happen with the remaining funds in the group's coffers.
Behavioral therapists at Legacy Health unionized in anticipation of the hospital's merger with Oregon Health and Science University. The two hospital systems have submitted their plans for the merger to state regulators. KBOO's Zachary Jones-Nure has more.
Oregon Health and Science University and Legacy Health have officially submitted merger plans to state regulators. Behavioral therapists at Legacy unionized in anticipation of this to protect themselves. 60 behavioral health therapists at Legacy Unity Center for Behavioral Health have voted to join the Oregon Nurses Association. They're also doubling the size of an existing bargaining unit at the hospital, which includes other mental health workers. Behavioral health therapist Megan Wilkinson-Smith says she and her coworkers didn't know about a potential merger until they heard it on the news.
We hope that we'll have more of a voice in expressing the things that we think could be helping our patients before they get to a point of needing hospitalization, but also afterwards and what that looks like for them.
Wilkinson-Smith says with the union, they hope to have a more standardized pay structure. ONA and other unions representing workers affected by the merger say they support it based on assurances from OHSU, including on job security, pay parity, and honoring union contracts. Access to mental health has been an issue in Oregon. Mental Health America ranking from 2022 placed the state third to last. Wilkinson-Smith says the union will help her and her colleagues better advocate for patients.
We hope that we'll have more of a voice in expressing the things that we think could be helping our patients before they get to a point of needing hospitalization, but also afterwards and what that looks like for them.
Wilkinson-Smith also says the union will give them more of a voice in Salem when it comes to state policies. Along with mental and behavioral health specialists, ONA represents more than 220 nurses at Legacy Unity Center for Behavioral Health. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Zachary Jones-Nure.
TriMet's board of directors just approved a new contract, which will boost worker wages by more than 13%. The Amalgamated Transit Union ATU Local 757 represents the vast majority of TriMet employees, more than 2,700 people, including bus and MAX operators, dispatchers, mechanics, maintenance service workers, and others. Local 757 members already ratified the new agreement in August. TriMet and ATU leaders negotiated a 4-year term for the new contract instead of the usual 3. They hope this will provide greater stability for both sides, as well as helping riders through downstream effects. The agreement increases union employee wages by 4% in December of 2024, followed by a 3% increase each year after. That comes out to a 13.64% wage increase over the 4 years. Hourly pay will also increase for those working maintenance shifts between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. TriMet also plans to increase the employer contribution to union employees' 401-A retirement plan by 1% now, with another 1% increase in the final year of the contract. This will bring TriMet's contribution for union employees to 10%. Other benefits for new and existing TriMet union employees include a new higher and continuing education tuition reimbursement of up to $5,250 per year, a new child care subsidy of up to $150 per month, two additional floating holidays, and more vacation time for employees who have worked for TriMet for at least 15 years. Finally, TriMet will also add new cleaning positions. This should mean more regular cleaning at TriMet facilities. Based on the other changes, riders should see fewer canceled trips. TriMet has offered a $7,500 hiring bonus for new operators for some time, as well as a $2,500 hiring bonus for positions including diesel mechanics and maintainers. The working and wage agreement applies to current and future union employees.
A new website called FundHubWA shows individuals and organizations funding resources for clean energy and efficiency projects in Washington state. As Eric Tegadoff reports, federal and state legislation has sent funding to go green to new heights.
Washington State has launched a new website that lets people and organizations know about ways they can fund going green. With resources for clean energy and efficiency projects at an all-time high, the state has created the portal FundHubWA to help navigate funding opportunities. That includes tax incentives, rebates, and state and federal grants. Amy Willis is with the Washington State Department of Commerce, which is running the site. She says Hub is an apt name for it and walks through how it works.
You say, I'm an individual, or I'm a farmer, or I'm a business, and I'm looking for funding opportunities for energy efficiency or for electric vehicles. And then it will present a variety of federal and state opportunities that are available.
FundHubWA offers resources from federal laws passed in recent years, including the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, CHIPS for America, the Inflation Reduction Act, and Washington State's Climate Commitment Act. The website is available for individuals and a wide range of organizations, including public agencies, tribal governments, and nonprofits. Carol Albert is the senior advisor for federal funding in Governor Jay Inslee's office. She says these funding sources are important for combating climate change.
There has never been a better time to get projects going in communities that are contributing to cleaner and healthier and more prosperous areas of Washington to really move away from fossil fuels.
Albert says FundHubWA could prove especially useful for local governments and rural communities. People in these areas often do more than one job, which can make it overwhelming to track all the available opportunities.
There are just not enough hours in the day, so the portal is a way for them to get to this information quickly and then assess if they or their communities would qualify for it.
The website is supported with funding from the Climate Commitment Act, which could be repealed in November if Initiative 2117 passes. Albert says regardless of the outcome of the election, the future of FundHubWA will be up to state lawmakers. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
Donald Trump blames Kamala Harris for the border crisis. Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will not tolerate a future with Hamas and Hezbollah on their borders. And Wisconsin faces another ballot box issue. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
These are the people that we don't want. You know, we all have big hearts and all that stuff. She let in 25,272 illegal aliens convicted of rape and other sex crimes.
Former President Donald Trump continues to blame Vice President Kamala Harris for a border crisis. At a Pennsylvania campaign rally, he claimed Harris is responsible for letting in what he called 600,000 migrant criminals of the worst kind, saying they're sadist thugs who are dealing drugs and committing human trafficking. CNN fact-checkers say Trump is wildly distorting the truth. Trump cited a just-released ICE report that says thousands of migrants convicted of homicide and other crimes are outside of immigration custody, but CNN found many came in under Trump, and the report didn't say how many are in civilian prisons. At an Arizona rally, Harris again noted that Trump got Senate Republicans to kill a bipartisan border bill earlier this year.
He picked up the phone and called some friends in Congress and said, stop the bill. Because, you see, he prefers to run on a problem instead of fixing a problem.
Trump also says without proof that Harris is mentally disabled. Meanwhile, world leaders say Israel's attacks on Hezbollah, including the group's leader, are close to starting a regional war. Defending the strikes to the United Nations General Assembly, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says they intend to stop Hezbollah from rocketing northern Israel.
We won't rest until our citizens can return safely to their homes. We will not accept a terror army perched on our northern border, able to perpetrate another October 7th-style massacre.
Netanyahu is also repeating that Hamas cannot be part of a post-war Gaza government, though critics in Israel say he's blocking any other options. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas says Netanyahu could have worked with him on a two-state solution after the October 7th attack, but refused to.
The Israeli government took advantage of what happened to launch an all-out war of genocide against Gaza. It committed and continues to commit war crimes, as acknowledged by the international community.
Teachers say partisan politics is demoralizing educators and discouraging others from joining them. GOP vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance has attacked the gay leader of a teachers union for not having children and said childless educators are brainwashing kids. Maggie Myers' attack teaches high school history in Philadelphia.
We're seeing politicians and leaders in the news talk poorly about us. We're seeing families and parents, unfortunately, who have kind of been turned against us and what we're trying to do in our schools.
Wisconsin is fighting over ballot drop boxes. Early this summer, the state Supreme Court reversed a near total ban on drop boxes for absentee ballots, but a Wisconsin mayor opposed to them held a public event where he removed one outside of City Hall, calling it insecure. Sam Liebert, with All Voting is Local, defends them.
They help so many types of voters, whether they're voters with disabilities, they're third shift workers, they're single parents. All types of people benefit from having ballot drop boxes.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with one of the organizers of the Portland Women's Strike coming up this Friday. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, KBOO presents Running on Air, the daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. On this episode, we'll be joined by three candidates for mayor, Josh Leek, Martin Ward, and Michael O'Callaghan. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 77. Today in history, in 1939, NBC broadcasts the first televised American football game. It was estimated to reach just 1,000 TV sets. The quote of the day is from American author Ta-Nehisi Coates, born on this day in 1975. He wrote in the book Between the World and Me, quote, "I would not have you descend into your own dream. I would have you become a conscious citizen of this terrible and beautiful world."
Two Alaska tribal groups are suing the federal government over the limits on how many pollock they can catch. They say the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is using outdated science to establish the limits. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Two large regional Alaska tribal groups took their fight to overhaul federal management of pollock fisheries to Anchorage U.S. District Court last week. The Association of Village Council Presidents and the Tanana Chiefs Conference are suing the National Marine Fisheries Service. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, both tribal organizations say the federal agency is using outdated environmental studies to set catch limits.
The tribes say the faulty data has contributed to the collapse of salmon runs. Salmon are not targeted in the pollock harvest, but are taken as bycatch. And although they are a tiny slice of the 4.4 billion pound fishery, AVCP's attorney Coralette Waite says the result has been devastating.
The reality on the ground is that every salmon counts. And unfortunately for our region and for our families and our community, there are winners when families go without salmon because of the impacts of using outdated strategies.
During oral arguments on Thursday, Kate Glover, an attorney for Earth Justice, spoke on behalf of the tribes. She told U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason that federal managers have failed to take into consideration major changes in the ecosystem due to a warming climate.
It's been breaking records in terms of loss of sea ice and the disappearance of the cold pool in the Bering Sea. Salmon runs have been at record lows in recent years.
Glover argued that federal managers are relying on data that is two decades old. The lawsuit calls for new studies and immediate management changes. In her response to the tribes, federal attorney Jennifer Sunduk said that there have been a number of new regulations that have resulted in lower bycatch and less impact on seabirds. And while Sunduk concedes that some of the changes in the Bering Sea ecosystem are unprecedented, she argued that temperature fluctuations are cyclical and not enough to affect the overall management of the fishery. She said the tribes are taking the data out of context. Judge Gleason has taken arguments from both sides under advisement and is expected to make a decision in the case in a few months. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Over the weekend, President Biden approved a major disaster declaration for North Carolina, including for the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, to help people access funds and resources to recover from Hurricane Helene. The funds are available for essential items like food and water, repairs, or for a temporary place to stay. In preparation for the storm, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians declared a state of emergency last week. The tribe still plans to hold its Cherokee Indian Fair this week. In a statement issued by tribal leaders, they said they're moving forward with the fair with a deep understanding of the devastation caused by the hurricane to surrounding areas. They said the fair represents a time to gather, reconnect, and strengthen bonds. The tribe will gather supplies during the fair to help those in need. Events are taking place across Canada Monday, Orange Shirt Day, which honors survivors of Indian residential schools. Also known as National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, it recognizes and reflects on the history and ongoing legacy of the schools and remembers the children who never returned home. Manitoba Premier Wab Kanu says events across the province are learning opportunities. In 2023, Manitoba established Orange Shirt Day as a provincial statutory holiday. On Friday, California Native American Day, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed 7 tribal bills. The bills introduced by Native American Assembly member James Ramos include protections for the Indian Child Welfare Act, strengthens the feather alert for missing Indigenous persons, and requires schools to teach about the impacts of missions and the gold rush. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
For people who may have been denied FEMA assistance after a disaster, there's hope. They can appeal. A free online tool available in both English and Spanish can help. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Hurricanes, wildfires, and other climate disasters can destroy people's homes and possessions. And while survivors are still reeling from that trauma, many then receive the devastating news that their application for FEMA assistance has been denied. Jeannie Ortiz-Ortiz of the American Bar Association's Disaster Legal Services Program says FEMA applications are often denied because they're missing information or lack sufficient documentation, and everyone has the right to file an appeal. But many people do not know that or how to begin.
It's very valid to feel overwhelmed and to feel that the processes in place may not be helping to you at this time, but there are resources available.
For example, a network of legal aid groups called Advocates for Disaster Justice offers a free online tool in both English and Spanish that helps people prepare their appeal.
It helps survivors by guiding them through the necessary steps of filing an appeal and ensuring that they meet FEMA's requirements for the appeal. So it's kind of like a guided interview, and it makes it easier for them to advocate for themselves.
So it can help people access the relief they need to rebuild and recover. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
A new Climate Accountability Research Project report lists the wealthy donors who gave $5.8 billion in tax-deductible donations to nonprofits working to stop or slow climate action through disinformation campaigns between 2020 and 2022. Eric Galatis has the details.
A new report shows how American taxpayers are subsidizing disinformation about climate change. Co-author Chuck Collins is with the Climate Accountability Research Project. He says people with ties to the fossil fuel industry are bankrolling groups trying to block action on climate change through tax-deductible donations.
There's 137 organizations that are actively involved in promoting climate disinformation, challenging the science, sowing doubt, blocking alternatives. Their goal is to run out the clock and keep extracting their profits.
Between 2020 and 2022, people gave these organizations nearly $6 billion in tax-deductible donations, which are entirely legal under the U.S. tax code. The U.S. Supreme Court has also ruled that financial contributions deserve the same First Amendment protections as speech, at least in political campaigns. Collins argues that because wealthy donors are essentially pushing the burden of building and maintaining roads, schools, and other essential services onto other taxpayers, the public deserves to know who they are.
They're opting out of paying their taxes. So the rest of us do have a public interest in knowing how that money is being used and whether it's being used in a way that influences Congress and influences public policy and takes us down a road that we may not want to go down.
Many donors are now listed online at climatecriminals.org, which also features a countdown to a deadline set in Paris to cut fossil fuel emissions in order to prevent the worst impacts of climate change. Collins says many more donors remain anonymous by contributing through groups, including donor-advised funds. He believes increasing transparency is important in removing barriers to serious climate action.
We should know who is blocking our ability to respond in a timely way to climate change, and we should hold those people accountable.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
The cost of a graduate degree has tripled since 2000. A new report calls for stronger regulations and greater transparency for financial risks associated with grad plus loans. Nadia Romlagan has the story.
The cost of a graduate degree tripled between 2000 and 2020, according to a new report from the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. Yet people with master's degrees, law or medical degrees, or PhDs still earn higher incomes than those with other education credentials. Catherine Morris with the center explains decreasing state investment in public higher education has led many universities to pass increased cost onto students. In some cases, because of increased federal financial aid, students have raised tuition to get more of the available money. She adds graduate enrollments, particularly for master's degrees, are growing.
Meanwhile, the median debt held by graduate students has increased from $34,000 to $50,000 over the same time period.
The report calls for better regulation of graduate student loans. It also outlines an in-fields earning premium test and a debt-to-earnings test students can use to help inform them of the risks, pros, and cons of taking on graduate debt. For some groups, the data show graduate education worsens existing earnings disparities. Morris says earnings among Black and Hispanic workers with graduate degrees are $16,000 less than those of all graduate degree workers. And graduate degrees don't buffer women from the wage gap.
Median earnings among women with graduate degrees is $85,000. For men, it's $119,000. And this is particularly significant because women currently make up the majority of graduate degree holders.
Morris adds she doesn't believe debt, even high levels of it, are concerning.
The bigger question is whether graduates can pay off that debt on their expected earnings while still working towards traditional markers of success, such as, you know, owning a home or starting a family.
74% of Gen Z student loan borrowers and 68% of millennials say they delayed a major financial life decision as a result of their debt, according to a survey by Bankrate. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. This is Nadia Romlagan for West Virginia News Service.
Fall is the most common time of year for birthdays. In September, the top month for new births. So experts have some recommendations to address one birth-related health condition, which is a big concern. Suzanne Potter has more on postpartum depression, reporting from California.
More new babies are born in the fall than any other time of year. But this also means the people who give birth may be heading into the winter months with what is sometimes called the baby blues. Experts say postpartum depression is more than just the fatigue and life changes that come with being a new parent. In California and across the country, there are more treatment options, including a relatively new fast-acting pill for severe postpartum depression called Zurzuvae. Dr. Donna O'Shea with United Healthcare advises women who feel they are struggling to seek help rather than trying to go it alone.
one in five women experience pregnancy-related mental health conditions. And of women who have postpartum depression, 20% will face suicidal thoughts and even attempt self-harm.
She says people have a higher risk of postpartum depression if they have a history of anxiety or depression, if they come from an under-resourced community, use drugs or alcohol, or if they experience fertility challenges, an unwanted pregnancy, or a difficult birth. Rhonda Smith, who heads the California Black Health Network, says equity issues are also at play here.
Only about 4% of mental health providers are Black. So trying to find a mental health service provider who looks like us, that is very, very difficult.
Women are also urged to contact their doctors, activate their personal support network, and find out if their company offers an employee assistance program that includes mental health resources. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 30th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, my co-anchor Josh Salem, Zachary Jones-Nure, and David Rosenberg. The producers tonight are also myself and Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Suzanne Potter, Mike Moen, Nadia Romlagon, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The engineer for tonight's show and the director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned for KBOO News in Depth. We're going to be speaking with the organizers of the Portland Women's Strike. Stick with us.